DCT Audio. The art of good listening.
You're listening to a podcast on the Audio Boom Network. This is A Mindful Life with me, Dave Thomas. Thank you for downloading this edition of the program. I do hope you enjoy it.
I'm Georgie Vesti, and I produce a podcast about professionals who work with death.
Welcome, Georgie. This podcast has been a long time coming. I've been so looking forward to it. There's lots to talk about, and I'm always interested in people and their childhoods and how it's moulded you into the person you are today, I suppose. So what was the motivations of the young Georgie?
Well, I think there's sort of a fairly consistent theme that started from quite a young age, which is a curiosity about death. I grew up in Australia on a property, on a farm. And for those people who work in or live in the country, you know, death is quite a familiar thing to come across when you're working on a farm environment. And particularly where we lived in Australia, which was in a fairly remote bit of Queensland, we got used to the idea of death being something that was very everyday. It wasn't exceptional, whether it was dead kangaroos being dragged off the road on our way to school, or whether it was cattle having to be destroyed because they'd got caught in flood water, or, you know, it was very much an everyday thing for us as country kids. So it meant that I was curious about death rather than frightened of it. And I think it also meant that it was sort of stripped of a sentimentality, you know, and I think if you have that from a quite a young age, that's quite formative.
Well, that's interesting because certainly in the West, death is something that's not talked about. I think one of the main reasons is because it reminds us of our own mortality.
I probably didn't have anything quite so well formed as that. But I mean, for instance, in the where we actually lived, where our house was, in our garden, there were two graves of children who had died that belonged to the people who had owned the property before us. And so that sort of thing is not that uncommon. And also deaths, because people being killed in car accidents or on horseback or whatever, light aircraft, you know, you were sort of more familiar with that growing up.
I really wasn't expecting what you just told me, that, you know, there was graves of two children in the garden, because that is something that doesn't happen. You can't bury somebody in your own garden. No. There are laws against that.
Yeah.
That is so, I was going to say bizarre. It's not bizarre. It's perfectly reasonable when you think about it, but that really does bring it to your doorstep, literally, doesn't it?
It does. And I mean, I remember on our property, you'd ride through certain paddocks, and I remember seeing really beautiful bush graves, you know, of people who'd obviously died, you know, who were connected to the property and were buried on the property. That wasn't so unfamiliar. Death wasn't sort of transported to another place to happen, i.e. even if you died in the local area, you sort of tended to stay buried in the local area. And because it was so rural, that was one of those things.
Interesting. So as you grew up, became an adult.
Allegedly.
What sort of things were you getting up to professionally?
I read archaeology at university, and then I in Australia, and then I came back to the UK and I started working in television. And I did that for a while, and then I started working in Parliament for a backbench committee on HIV and AIDS. And that was in what I call the post-Princess Diana moment, when in the 90s, when AIDS was a very bleak and depressing and very unglamorous disease. So that brought me into contact with a lot of very young people who were dealing with death at a very high rate. You know, when we talk about the pandemic and COVID, you know, for those of us who are older, we remember that.
Yeah, because young pandemic. People aren't supposed to die, are they?
No. And so that was pretty, working with fairly traumatized young people, and very motivated and incredible people to be lucky enough to work with. And I think that sort of then led into working on a campaign where the fathers of two pilots who were accused of causing, who were killed but accused of causing the Mull of Kintyre crash in 1994. I worked with them as a lobbyist for many years, and also with another organisation with families whose relatives had been murdered abroad. So there's always been this slight link with death and actually really seeking justice. But within that time, I've also had a couple of stints working as a volunteer in the coroner's service. And that's brought me into contact with some extraordinary people who, in hearing their stories, that really then brought me full circle back to the idea of doing Dead Honest and having giving those people a platform, because there are these extraordinary people doing the work we hope someone else is doing. And they don't get any kudos. They're often paid really poorly and very badly recognized. And yet without them, our society wouldn't function. So I wanted to give those people a platform. And that's what brought me to Dead Honest. And I know that they're really helping people at a time when most people will be turning their heads and not wanting to get involved. And I have just enormous respect for that.
You mentioned your podcast, Dead Honest. I think it 2021 that
yeah,
came out?
It actually came out in I'm a terrible procrastinator. It actually came out in about 2020. It did take me a while to get the confidence to feel that I had mastered this technology. I thought this was going to be really simple to master. Being a sort of, you know, I'm an older, you know, I'm in my 50s, so I'm used to having a fair degree of competence around things. And I thought, how hard can this be? And actually, I found it unbelievably challenging. I'm very, very mindful that and respectful of the time that people give to my podcast. So I want to make sure it's really good and worth listening to.
Obviously it was good because yeah. You ended up being podcast of the year, was it?
Yes, there was the British Podcast Awards.
Which is brilliant. That's yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, I was really chuffed about that. But I think part of that, and I think one of the reasons I'm really proud of Dead Honest, but one of the reasons I think that it works is because I give the people I interview total editorial control over their interviews. And I don't just mean, well, I'll play it back to you and if you don't like this bit, I mean, genuinely, if they said to me at the end of our interview, I actually don't want you to use any of that, I wouldn't use any of it. It's totally up to them. And I think when you give people that control, you're giving them your respect, you're giving them your trust, you know, and I think it's the quality of the responses that my guests gave to me, that it wasn't me, but it was actually possibly the process that enabled the podcast to be seen to be of the quality that they were.
So what sort of people did you talk to over the series?
Right. Well, the people I wanted to interview were not first responders, what I call more second responders. So the people who were behind the people who were on the front line. And in that, I interviewed people who were police divers, mortuary technicians, wonderful woman who's a former police crisis negotiator, death doulas, coroner's officers, funeral directors, wonderful railway chaplain. So a very diverse group of people. And most of them had some connection, funnily enough, with the police because they'd either been trained by the police or had, yeah. You know, been in the police. So that was quite a thing. But then I also interviewed a couple of people, and one guy I came across was at the end of an interview I was doing with two coroner's officers who were talking about the suicides that they have to attend in their local area, which has a very distinctive location where people take their lives. And as we were walking out to the car, I happened to say to one of the coroner's officers, he was talking to me and I was thanking him. And he said, you know, and of course, once we've left the scene, you know, we've got to get someone to go and pick up the car. I thought, is that a job? Of course it's a job. Somebody's got to go and recover the cars of those people who've taken their lives at that beauty spot. So that led me on to interviewing one of my guests, a chap called Mac Hobbs, who's a tow truck recovery driver. So there are people who also come into contact with death as a result of the job that they do. And another woman was a wonderful woman who runs an organization called Remember My Baby, Cheryl Johnson, and she photographs stillborn babies. Now, she's a volunteer. So it's not just people behind the sort of formal process of death, but people who are sitting slightly to the edge of death as well.
Do you think all the people that you spoke to, did they have something in common with each other I'm not talking about the jobs and the content, the personality or their motivation.
Yeah, I think it. I think that yes, they did, and I think there were a few things I could see. Number one, this was more of a vocation than a career.
Mm.
Yes. I don't think I've ever met a group of individuals who have a higher job satisfaction, which is possibly surprising to people when you think of the jobs that they're doing.
Yes.
I think it was pretty consistent that dealing with child death was the hardest thing that all of them dealt with, and I know, for instance, Anita Hardy, the mortuary technician. It was really touching to hear her talk about. We keep the little ones close to us, so they put them in the refrigerated area, but it's as close to where they are.
Yes,
and just the tenderness of how they deal with the bodies and. Just in terms of washing the little outfits that they'll have been brought to the mortuary and making sure that they go back to the parents in the outfit that they were wearing.
Yeah.
And that even for the even tiniest little babies that are, you know, only sort of maybe, you know, premature, you know, as she says, you know, you can't go to Asda and buy a baby grow for a 6-month-old fetus, you know, but there are people who knit those little garments. And so that's a sort of the tenderness you'd be brought into in those interviews.
And I tell you what, it's those little things that absolutely mean the world to families.
Yeah.
The last few years of my police career before I retired was on child protection.
Wow.
And one of the biggest conundrums was to go to a baby death and treat those mum and dad. You know, you have to be aware of that they're going through grief. But you also simultaneously have to be aware that they could be suspects in a murder.
Yeah.
And to walk that line was incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
And there was nothing you could learn from one job that you could take to another, really. Every job was unique. Everyone was equally as difficult.
Do you think those were the deaths that affected you the most?
No, strangely enough. I think that the deaths that affected me the most were on road policing, probably because it involved innocent people, usually in car crashes, but it was also the finality of it. And I've been to hundreds of scenes, fatal scenes, and seen probably most ways a human being could die. But what really chilled me was when you have, especially like with a pedestrian walking down the street, and there'd be CCTV of the scene, and you know they step into the road and they get hit by a car. And what used to chill me was the fact that, and you'd look at the timestamp and the counter, thinking in 10 seconds you're going to be dead, and you have no idea about what's going to happen. And it still chills me to this day. That's the uncertainty and fragility of life, isn't it?
And how has that informed your own thoughts around death?
Oh, wow. That's a big question, Georgie. I think as you get older and you realise that you've lived more years than you're likely to have left, it certainly is a topic that starts to come on the horizon, doesn't it? I'm not a religious person, but I am a spiritual person. But certainly there is an order in this universe. There is no two ways about that. We probably aren't intelligent enough to even ask the right questions, let alone understand the answer if we got them. So part of that is an unfathomable, and I try not to think about it because you drive yourself mad.
Well, then let me ask you a different question, but informed by that experience of seeing those, of how the fragility of life, and it's a question I sometimes ask the people I interview, but you know, what has doing the job that you did in road policing, what has that taught you about love?
Well, what it's shown me, I don't know if it's taught me anything, is that the huge hole that's left when somebody does die. You know, we have family liaison officers in the police. I used to do that role. That was a volunteer role, that. You didn't get paid any extra for it. It was something you volunteered, and that was a difficult job. That's the person that knocks on the door and says he or she has died. In fact, I remember one incident, and again, it just goes back to the finality. And there was a guy that was going out on his motorbike one Sunday morning in his 50s. He'd just retired. His wife was about to retire. They were going to enjoy the rest of their lives together. We were going to move away. And he'd gone out on his bike every Sunday, as he normally does, a safe rider. And for some reason, that particular morning on a particular bend, he thought he was Barry Sheen, and he cut the corner and had a head-on with a lorry and died at the scene. I knocked on the door, and people know why you're there because it's written all over your face. You can't hide it. And one thing I have learnt, actually, certainly doing the FLO work, is that you can't pussyfoot about the message that you give, because people don't, you know, if you go around and say, well, he didn't make it, or he's not coming back, well, what do you mean by, you've got to be, I'm afraid your husband's died. You know, you've got to be as blunt as that, because they're already in shock before you've told them anything. But this particular case, I remember that there was a pan of soup on the cooker, just simmering, and he was literally due home in those moments, and, you know, I had to switch the pan off. What a metaphor for death.
Hmm.
I still get upset about it now.
What upsets you?
I think it's just how cruel it is. And I've done it loads of times, given death warn messages. And they don't get easier, they get harder. Because every time you go and speak with somebody, it's like a transaction, isn't it? And you leave a bit of yourself with them, and they give a bit of them to you. And you've done it 50, 60 times. There's nothing left to give. You've given everything then. You know, FLO work in the police definitely has a shelf life.
I think it's really surprising, because I interviewed a wonderful woman, Louise Lou Pye, who, she was an FLO, and that thing, as you just said, about being a volunteer. I never realised that was something you had to do in addition to your day job as police officers.
Yeah.
And the other thing I thought was quite surprising, when you, going back to that earlier question we were saying before about what are the similarities between the people I've interviewed, I always assumed that the trauma that the people I interviewed, if they experienced the trauma, it was because of what they had seen.
Mm.
And what I have come away with more is actually more damage can be done to people by their organizations than by their job of actually
attending
a fatal or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And that's not something, as a civilian, for want of a better word, I had really thought would be the case.
Mm. They say if you have a traumatic experience, if you're not addressing that within a couple of days, it's locked in then with you for life, and it will cause problems further down the line.
Now, what I meant by that, though, was more the fact that it was the way people have been treated by their organisations that has actually caused them almost more trauma than the scenes they've gone to.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because they have either been, you know, like, take the FLO work. I remember Lou saying that you'd go off to do a 10-minute conversation with a family you were liaising with over a long period of time, but that just might be the day that was the birthday of the child that had been killed.
Mm.
And that might just be the time that the mother had said, actually, now I want to show you his bedroom. And what are you going to do? Turn around and say, well, I've only got 10 minutes. And so you'd come back to the station after 2 hours, and people would be like, well, where have you been?
Yeah.
So I just thought that was quite interesting, that maybe that role isn't as well understood, perhaps.
Well, certainly in the police anyway, there's operational requirements, aren't there? And people realise that as an FLO, you do have to give a lot of time, but as long as it doesn't interfere with the running of the organisation, I think it's a lot better than it used to be. It certainly is. And I have been retired for 18 months now, and I'm sure it's got even better. The other thing with being an FLO, which perhaps a lot of people don't realise, that you were allowed no more than 3 cases.
Mm.
Well, I've run with 5 or 6, and especially if they come close together.
Mm.
And the reason that is because there's so few FLOs, because the people that aren't FLOs see the impact it has on the FLOs and think, I ain't volunteering for that. But the problem you have is when you are running a lot of cases, and it's happened to me where I've been sat down with a family, and you either get the name wrong, the person's died, or you just hesitate because you're thinking, crikey, what job is this? But they, quite rightly, take it as, oh, is that what my son means to you? You can't even remember his name. That can be a really awkward moment, and it's just purely because you've got so much going on in your head. It's an unintended consequence, isn't it, of that? And a lot of families that you support, you'll be supporting for 2 years, especially if there's a case, you know, and there's a driver that's been responsible for a death. The way the criminal justice system now, it can take at least 2 years. So you're supporting them all the way. And it can be absolutely draining. But Going back to the question you asked a few questions ago about the work and how it affects you, and I think you just get, for me, I just got tired of death. People say, well, what's my purpose in life? And your purpose in life is to live. You know, you weren't meant to be somebody. You're not meant to be save somebody. Your purpose is to live. And when you're in that environment where all you're dealing with is death, you kind of get a little bit depressed about it.
Was there one death in particular, do you think, that pushed you over?
I did have a breakdown towards the end of my career, but that was a combination of bereavement, some childhood issues, and police work, and it all came together. It was the aftermath that affected me, not the deaths themselves. Like I said, I've been to some horrendous scenes. It was the hole that it left.
The human cost behind.
Yeah. And that's what affected me, I think.
So what attracted you to want to be a traffic officer, knowing that you must have known that by definition you'd be attending fatal accidents as a significant part of your role, or at least where people have been very badly injured?
Well, I suppose it's down to, and I suppose it's similar to you in some respects, but you're doing it in a different way. It's one of service. The other thing I've always sort of gone by or said to myself is that, well, if I don't do it, who else will? It's that kind of roll your sleeves up. But yeah, I suppose ultimately it's a personal service, a gift to the community, I suppose, is one way of looking at it.
And I think that's a wonderful way of looking at it. And that is, in a sense, why that gift is, you know, as I say, you know, with the people I talk to, you know, you're doing the jobs that nobody else wants to do. But wow, at some considerable cost. And I mean, when we were talking before about, you know, what are some of the unifying things, and perhaps in the people that you've interviewed as well, I've often asked people, how do you decompress?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, everybody's different, aren't they, as to how they decompress. I retired from the police service. I didn't do my full 30. I retired at 25 years. And one of the reasons was, two reasons, actually. And they were both said to me by my counsellor. She said that this trauma, it'll always be there. You'll never get rid of it. So that was okay. And the next thing she said was that you'll never get well in the place that made you ill.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I thought, yeah, I need to get out. So by coming out of the job was in some ways my decompression, which then brings you on to the question of, well, if you hadn't, how would you decompress? And I'm not sure I have the answer for that. And I'm not sure many people do, because that's why we're seeing so many police officers and other people like nurses and firefighters. That's where they're struggling with their mental health at the moment, because it's just the sheer relentlessness of the workload. There is no rest. Decompression needs time, but the cops don't have time. They just simply do not have time. So therefore, they're not decompressing. And a short answer to your question is that, you know, I go walking a lot. I go cycling. I go camping in wild places. And sometimes you just have to get away from it, don't you? And just have a bit of that silence, I think. Just let go.
I mean, that's one of the things that I found when I was talking to people, that if there was one unifying way that people decompressed, it was dogs. Dogs had a really big part to play in restoring their sense of equilibrium after a really crappy day.
Dogs are the perfect human beings. That's how human beings should be.
Exactly. That's a great way of describing.
Because they're not bothered about what day you've had.
Yeah.
Or whether you're angry or sad. They're always the same, aren't they?
Yeah. I remember getting a letter from a woman whose brother had taken his life. I think it was, she had listened to the episode on the railway chaplain, and, you know, I was stunned to discover there's a death on the railway every 30 hours in the UK.
Really?
Yeah, really high. And it was just, anyway, she said, I listened to that episode, and she said, for the first time, I understood better where he was in his head and what had happened. And that wasn't the intention,
no,
obviously, but of me making it. But when you get those connections with people and you think, yeah, that's, you know, forget awards, forget downloads and whatever, it's that you've opened a door in a way, and help someone. Yeah.
Priceless.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I always think that thing of, you know, we used to say that in the coroners.
What a gift you've left. Well, I suppose if you're talking about deaths on railway, I'm assuming you're relating to suicides. Not all of them will be suicides.
Not all are suicides. And I think not all are suicides, but a large majority are. And I think one of the things I was very surprised by when I did the podcast and in doing the podcast is how often I came across suicide as an issue, whether it was a very high percentage of the police divers' caseloads, suicides, you know, that the railways, it, you know, dealing with the recovery driver up at the landmark where people are leaving their cars, coroner's officers, you know, that it's suicide has sort of, you know, the crisis negotiator, it's in every level of how you respond as emergency services.
I mean, we were talking about this the other day, weren't we, about bereavement and how it is the loneliest of traumas, I think. Of all the traumas to suffer, it's the loneliest. But suicide is like death with a cherry on the cake, isn't it, for the family, because it brings all those feelings of guilt and should have done more, or was it me, or, you know, all those things. I pile all that on top of grief.
Yeah.
That is a living hell.
Yeah. And I think also there, you know, given it is so much more common in our experience of, you know, in the way we come across it, even things, and in fact, the next episode I'm putting out is talking about, in part, it talks about suicide in the workplace and how people manage after that. Because also, whilst families are given perhaps a little bit more support than they were in the past, work colleagues are often very, very forgotten. When I was talking to Liam Johnson, the railway chaplain, he recounts an incident where police officers were attending a death on the tracks and discovered the warrant card and realised it was one of their own. And I just think, how do you come back from a day like that? Do you know what I mean? That's why I just have such incredible respect for the people doing this work. I mean,
I have learned, and it's the easiest thing to say and it's the hardest thing to do, let it go. It's as simple as that. It's so simple, let it go. But doing it is
hard.
Is a lifetime work for some people.
Yeah.
Which is why meditation and yoga and all sorts
of things.
I'm
really crap at that stuff. I'm really crap at mindfulness and meditation.
It's like me saying, Georgie, for the next minute, I don't want you to think of an elephant.
Yeah. I've been picturing it now.
Yes, as am I. And that's it.
Yeah.
But the trick is,
yeah,
you're thinking of an elephant. Don't beat yourself up because I've just said don't.
Yeah. So let it go as well.
So my mate's a Buddhist. Mm. He said, imagine your brain is the train station and your thoughts are the train. He says, just let that train go through the station. It might even stop. Just don't get on.
Enlightenment doesn't come from sitting on a mountaintop watching a sunrise. It's usually trauma. That life becomes so unbearable that you go, something has to shift.
Yes.
And I know in my own circumstances, one of the reasons I haven't been making podcasts in the last year is because my sister died and my mother died. And a lot of things came up because of that for me. But there has been a shift in me since those events took place. And I am more able to let things pass. And my new mantra is, oh, well. Which doesn't sound very spiritual, but it's where I've sort of got to after a year of loss.
I mean, you have done your podcast and spoke to lots of people who are experts in dealing with death. You will have learned a lot of things. I have learned a lot of things about death. But when it happens to you, I don't think it means anything. Everything I've learned, so what? It didn't.
I disagree. And maybe I'm talking about more the mechanics of it, but actually it was one of those things. I made Dead Honest because I wanted people to hear these amazing people. When my mother and my sister died, I realized that I'd actually almost been studying a syllabus of death, and so much of the incredible, I'd obviously by osmosis or whatever, taken in some really, really profoundly good advice from the people I'd interviewed, which was so helpful in the way I interacted with those two deaths from a very mechanical point of view, just in terms of how I chose to, you know, with my mother who lived in Australia, for instance, you know, we were living here in the UK. I knew I wasn't ever going to get back in time to see her when she was alive. It was very unlikely. So, but I had appointed a funeral director who I knew and had said, set up in advance. I said, you know, I want to see her at home. I want her to be on a cooling bed when I get there. And I'm so glad I knew such things as cooling beds existed because my mother was there and looking incredibly serene and peaceful when I arrived, you know, 36 hours later. And in fact, we chose, my sister and I, to keep her at home for another four days because we just wanted to be with her.
Yes.
I'm so glad I felt the confidence to ask for that to happen. I'm so glad that when I was, you know, my sister, you know, when we were giving our clothes to the funeral director and, you know, for her to be dressed in. And I said to her, because I'd learnt this from Anita in the mortuary, you know, when we are dressing the bodies, when we're preparing the bodies, we're listening to music. And, you know, she told me about a family who had requested some. And I said to this funeral, you know, worker, I said, you know, when you're in the mortuary, are you listening to music? And she said, yeah, we do. And I said, you know, would you play Fleetwood Mac, Go Your Own Way, when you're dressing her in her beautiful party dress and her, you know, gold shoes and whatever. And just having some way of participating in that process with the meanness of me and the herness of her was really, you know, knowing I could sit there and watch her casket go into the cremation chamber, you know, that my hand would be the last thing that touched her before she was incinerated. And I can't find a better word for that. But then I remember so clearly sitting with my sister, and I've not talked about this publicly, but you know, and in this beautiful little crematorium, if and such a thing does exist in Spain, and just watching the heat haze coming up from the chimney of my sister, and then the smoke in the twilight, and just, it was so sacred.
Yes.
And it was so primal.
So I think what, I guess what you're saying is that because of your experiences of the people you've spoken to in your podcast, you were able to conduct the process of the funeral, at least, and saying goodbye to your mother. You've left with no regrets.
Oh, none.
Regret is an awful thing
it's
to live with.
It's an awful thing. You know, I was speaking to someone recently who was talking about the death of his partner. And he said right at the end, there were so many people in the room. There was the parents and some friends and whatever. He said, all I wanted to do was climb into bed with her and hold her. And I now know I have the confidence to say, this is my time.
Yes.
I want to be held by my husband or my partner.
Yes.
And I love you all dearly, but actually the last arms I want to be held in are my husband's or my children's. And to advocate that for myself, if I'm awake, alive, whatever. But if I'm on the other end of that, to say, what do I want? To have the confidence of, what do I want? How do I want this to be? Not how other people want me to make this. We don't have to be hidebound by tradition. We can make our own traditions. You know, there's such a natural way of doing these things now.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can see me, but other people can't see me. But I am, you know, I am, this is not sad for me.
No.
This is happy
you have a,
memories.
A radiant smile on your face as we speak.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lovely thing they do in this country, and they probably do it in other countries as well, is now they're having graveyard. It sounds such a horrible word, doesn't it? But it's the only word that comes to mind at the moment. But it's full of trees.
Oh, natural burial grounds.
And people's ashes are buried, and then they plant a tree on top, and that is a, like a living headstone. And I can't think of a more beautiful
and
way
the,
to celebrate somebody's life.
At the UK, you know, we can be very down on England and whatever, but one of the things I'm really proud of, there is a really, really strong funeral movement that is very progressive globally. You know, they have been absolutely leading the way in natural burial grounds, in coming up with different ways of people being cremated. Well, although that's a bit more in the States, they're doing water cremation now, which is where people are sort of dissolved in a sense. But, you know, there's so much creativity in this country around funerals and how we are buried. So there are these wonderful alternatives, and I would really urge anyone who is facing this, because there are things that you can do to bring yourself into the what feels like a taboo area and shine a light and make you feel you have a bit more ownership on it.
What do you think bereavement, not only from other people's experiences but your own, what has it taught you about yourself?
I think the one piece of advice I've been given that I have been able to act on, it was given to me by an incredibly dear friend of mine, and she said, you've just got to feel the feels. So if that means sitting at the dinner table with my kids and not just a quiet tear coming down my face, but really blubbing, you know, snot, you know, on the dinner table, that's what it is. And then it passes. It's like a weather system. If you back it up and back it up, you'd no more swallow vomit. Why swallow tears?
Yeah.
Get this stuff out of your system.
Let it go.
Let it go. And then that you then also show those around you. It's safe to grieve that violently, if it has to be violent by other people's estimations. But also, let's change the temperature of what real grief looks like. Mm. It's not a silent tear and a rainbow. It is snot at the dinner table. Maybe that's just what it's got to be. And then 2 hours later, you might be watching Strictly and having a giggle. And then people around you go, oh, okay, it doesn't have to stay like that. You may not. It may go on and on and on. But I was just that thing of allow yourself.
What I've learned is that, as I say, I'm not a religious person, I'm a spiritual, and I don't know the answers to the universe.
Oh, very disappointing.
I know, I'm sorry, I failed you. When you look at science and the universe, and everything's changing all the time, it's in constant state of change, and energy can't be destroyed. That is a fact. And they've also proved that an atom can be in two places at once. There is some weird stuff going on in the universe that we can't even pretend to understand. But what I'm saying is, change is the law of the universe. So therefore, we are constantly changing because we're part of it. And I don't think we should be afraid to change.
Not at all. And to change and be informed by grief. I think that's one of the things that I'm you know, maybe we're getting a bit technical now, but that thing again of being with families, that, you know, I have a real bugbear about the word closure. Let's give them closure. To me, closure is something other people want you to have so they can stop worrying about you. That's how I see closure.
Well, you're setting a limit, aren't you?
Yeah.
You've got an opening and a closing.
And a closing. And it is. It's about making other people comfortable.
And you live between those two limits.
Yeah, exactly. And that thing of, no, it's you are going to be different after this experience. And that's not a bad thing. No. I can say for myself, it's been an amazing thing. Having said that, I am only dealing with the death of my mother, who was 88, and my sister, who was pretty much wanting to be in a place where she wasn't here anymore, so for health reasons. So that would be very different to a child. That would be very different to a partner. So I preface that, you know, retrospectively by saying that.
I think the morbid side of our human beingness, if you will, is that I think sometimes we do try to imagine, well, what would that feel like? But it's until it happens. And you can talk to as many people that have lost, you know, family members and partners, but every experience is different. And until it happens, you won't know.
Very true.
Mm.
I mean, do you get called morbid? I get, you know, oh my God, you're so morbid. And I'm like, hang on a sec. No one says, oh my God, you're so life affirming, or you're so life curious. Life and death are, this, you know, one and the same thing. Okay, so I'm death curious. How is that any different from being life curious?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, morbid is having a fascination with death, I suppose, or if you're morbid about something.
But nobody says, you know, you've got a fascination with life, and say that in a derogatory way, do they?
No.
So why is having a fascination or curiosity about death that different?
Yeah.
And isn't that also part about keeping that taboo in that
place?
Because
it's one and the same, isn't it?
It is one and the same. And if we don't normalise that, then we're demonising it.
You can't have life without death. So why do we not want to speak about death?
I think we're getting better at it. I do actually think I think COVID has slightly changed that.
Yes.
I think, you know, death became a community thing as opposed to the individual. And I think our death literacy has vastly improved. I know when I started Dead Honest, I was, you know, there weren't that many podcasts about death, but there are now a lot of podcasts around grief and bereavement. And so as a sort of barometer of society, I think there is more openness to it. There is a little bit more fluency around it. So I think it's, that to me is encouraging.
Yeah. And I think by talking about death, we live a better life.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's the that sense of, you know, mortality meeting you. It's like, it doesn't make you want to die faster. It makes you want to live more. And I think that's a wonderful thing.
Georgie Vesti, thank you so much today. I feel like it's the Georgie Vesti show, actually.
Oh,
I think you took me to some places I wasn't expecting. So, and as always, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
DCT Audio. The art of good listening.